with Islamic and Judaic culture, they came to act as a clearinghouse for new ideas, new dimensions of knowledge, new sciences. They contributed to the development of surveying, map-making, road-building, and navigation. They possessed their own seaports, shipyards, and fleet, a fleet both commercial and military, which was among the first to use the magnetic compass. And as soldiers, the Templars' need to treat wounds and illness made them adept in the use of drugs. The Order maintained its own hospitals with its own physicians and surgeons. The Temple in Europe grew increasingly wealthy, powerful, and complacent. Not surprisingly, perhaps, it also grew increasingly arrogant, brutal, and corrupt. But while the Templars attained both prosperity and notoriety in Europe, the situation in the Holy Land had seriously deteriorated. In 1185, King Baudouin, the IV of Jerusalem, died. In the dynastic quarrel that followed, Gerard de Rithfort, Grand Master of the Temple, led his knights, along with the rest of the Christian army, into a rash, misconceived, and disastrous battle. The Christian forces were virtually annihilated. And 2 months later, Jerusalem itself, captured nearly a century before, was again in Saracen hands. During the following century, the situation became increasingly hopeless. By 1291, the Holy Land was almost entirely under Muslim control. Only Acre remained, and in May 1291, this last fortress was lost as well. The Templars established their new headquarters in Cyprus, but with the loss of the Holy Land, they had effectively been deprived of their raison d'être. The Order began to turn its attention towards Europe, hoping to find there a justification for its continued existence. A century before, the Templars had presided over the foundation of another chivalric religious military order, the Teutonic Knights. The latter were active in small numbers in the Middle East, but by the mid-13th century had turned their attention to the northeastern frontiers of Christendom. Here, they had carved out an independent principality for themselves, the Ordensstaat, or Ordensland, which encompassed almost the whole of the eastern Baltic. In this principality, the Teutonic Knights enjoyed an unchallenged sovereignty. From the very inception of the Ordensstaat, the Templars had envied the independence and immunity of their kindred order. After the fall of the Holy Land, they thought increasingly of a state of their own in which they might exercise the same untrammeled authority and autonomy as the Teutonic Knights. Unlike the Teutonic Knights, however, the Templars were not interested in the harsh wilderness of Eastern Europe. They dreamed of founding their state on more accessible, more congenial soil, that of the Languedoc. From its earliest years, the Temple had maintained a certain warm rapport with the Cathars, especially in the Languedoc. Many wealthy landowners, Cathars themselves or sympathetic to the Cathars, had donated vast tracts of land to the Order. Bertrand de Blanchefort, fourth Grand Master of the Order, came from a Cathar family. During the Albigensian Crusade, the Templars ostensibly remained neutral. On occasion, they do seem to have taken up arms on these refugees' behalf, and an inspection of the Order's rolls towards the beginning of the Albigensian Crusade reveals a major influx of Cathars into the Temple's ranks, where not even Simon de Montfort's crusaders would dare to challenge them. Indeed, in the Languedoc Temple, officials were more frequently Cathar than Catholic. By virtue of their contact with Islamic and Judaic cultures, the Templars had already absorbed a great many ideas alien to Orthodox Roman Christianity. Templar masters, for example, often employed Arab secretaries, and many Templars were fluent in Arabic. A close rapport was also maintained with Jewish communities, financial interests, and scholarship. Through the influx of Cathar recruits, they were now exposed to Gnostic dualism as well. By 1306, Philip IV of France was acutely anxious to rid his territory of the Templars. They were arrogant and unruly. They were a professional military force much stronger and better organized than any he himself could muster. Philip had no control over the order. He owed it money. He coveted the Templars' immense wealth, and having applied to join the order as a postulant, he had suffered the indignity of being haughtily rejected. These factors, together with the alarming prospect of an independent Templar state at his back door, were sufficient to spur the king to action, and heresy was a convenient excuse. Philippe first had to enlist the cooperation of the Pope, to whom, in theory at any rate, the Templars owed allegiance and obedience. Between 1303 and 1305, the French king and his ministers engineered the kidnapping and death of one pope, Boniface VIII, and quite possibly the murder by poison of another, Benedict XI. Then, in 1305, Philippe managed to secure the election of his own candidate, the Archbishop of Bordeaux, to the vacant papal throne. The new pontiff took the name Clement V. Indebted as he was to Philippe's influence, he could hardly refuse the king's demands. And these demands included the eventual suppression of the Knights Templar. Philippe managed to secure the election of his own candidate, the Archbishop of Bordeaux, to the vacant papal throne. The new pontiff took the name Clement V. Indebted as he was to Philippe's influence, he could hardly refuse the king's demands. And these demands included the eventual suppression of the Knights Templar. Philippe could at last move, and when he delivered his blow, it was sudden, swift, efficient, and lethal. He issued sealed and secret orders to his seneschals throughout the country. At dawn on Friday, October the 13th, 1307, all Templars in France were to be seized and placed under arrest by the king's men, their precipitaries placed under royal sequestration, their goods confiscated. But although Philippe's objective of surprise might seem to have been achieved, his primary interest, the order's immense wealth, eluded him. It is doubtful whether Philippe's surprise attack on the order was as unexpected as he or subsequent historians believed. Shortly before the arrests, the Grand Master, Jacques de Molay, called in many of the order's books and extant rules and had them burnt. There is persuasive evidence of some sort of organized flight by a particular group of knights, virtually all of whom were in some way connected with the order's treasurer. It's not perhaps surprising, therefore, that the treasure of the temple, together with almost all its documents and records, should have disappeared. In France, the arrested Templars were tried and many subjected to torture. Strange confessions were extracted and even stranger accusations made. Grim rumours began to circulate about the country. The Templars supposedly worshipped a devil called Baphomet. At their secret ceremonies, they supposedly prostrated themselves before a bearded male head, which spoke to them and invested them with occult powers. Unauthorized witnesses of these ceremonies were never seen again. And there were other charges as well, which were even more vague. Of infanticide, of teaching women how to abort, of obscene kisses at the induction of postulants, of homosexuality. But of all the charges levelled against these soldiers of Christ, one stands out as most bizarre and seemingly improbable. They were accused of ritually denying Christ, of repudiating, trampling, and spitting on the cross. In France, at least, the fate of the arrested Templars was effectively sealed. At the same time, the king continued to bully the Pope, demanding ever more stringent measures against the order. After resisting for a time, the Pope gave way in 1312, and the Knights Templar were officially dissolved. But in Philippe's domains, the trials, inquiries, and investigations continued for another 2 years. At last, in March 1314, Jacques de Molay, the Grand Master, and Geoffroy de Charnay, preceptor of Normandy, were roasted to death over a slow fire. With their execution, the Templars ostensibly vanished from the stage of history. But the order did not cease to exist. Given the number of knights who escaped, or who were acquitted, it would be surprising if it had. Philippe had tried to influence his fellow monarchs, hoping thereby to ensure that no Templar anywhere in Christendom should be spared. His attempt was not altogether successful. Philippe's own son-in-law, for example, Edward II of England, at first rallied to the order's defence. Eventually, pressured by both the Pope and the French king, he complied with their demands, but only partially and tepidly. Although most Templars in England seemed to have escaped completely, a number were arrested. Of these, however, most received only light sentences, sometimes no more than a few years' penance in abbeys and monasteries where they lived in generally comfortable conditions. Elsewhere, the elimination of the Templars met with even greater difficulty. Scotland, for instance, was at war with England at the time, and the consequent chaos left little opportunity for implementing legal niceties. Thus the papal bulls dissolving the order were never proclaimed in Scotland, and in Scotland, therefore, the order was never technically dissolved. According to legend, and there is evidence to support it, the order maintained itself as a coherent body in Scotland for another 4 centuries. In Lorraine, which was part of Germany at the time, the Templars were supported by the Duke of the Principality. A few were tried and exonerated. Most, it seems, obeyed their preceptor, who reputedly advised them to shave their beards, don secular garb, and assimilate themselves into the local populace. In Germany proper, the Templars openly defied their judges, threatening to take up arms. Intimidated, their judges pronounced them innocent. And when the order was officially dissolved, many German Templars found a haven in the Hospitallers of St. John and in the Teutonic Order. In Spain, too, the Templars resisted their persecutors and found a refuge in other orders. Thus, in a number of diverse ways, the Templars survived the attack of October the 13th, 1307. In greatly abridged form, this is the history of the Knights Templar as writers have accepted and presented it, and as we encountered it in our research. But we quickly discovered that there was another dimension to the Order's history, considerably more elusive, more provocative, and more speculative. Even during their existence, a mystique had come to surround the Knights. After the Temple's demise, the mystique persisted. The final recorded act in the Order's history had been the burning of the last Grand Master, Jacques de Molay, in March 1314. As the smoke from the fire slowly choked the life from his body, Jacques de Molay is said to have issued an imprecation from the flames. According to tradition, he called his persecutors, Pope Clement and King Philippe, to account for themselves before the court of God within the year. Within a month, Pope Clement was dead, supposedly from a sudden onslaught of dysentery. By the end of the year, Philippe was dead as well, from causes that remain obscure to this day. The apparent fulfilment of the Grand Master's curse lent credence to belief in the Order's occult powers. By the 18th century, various secret and semi-secret confraternities were lauding the Templars as both precursors and mystical initiates. Many Freemasons of the period appropriated the Templars as their own antecedents. Certain Masonic rites or observances claimed direct lineal descent from the Order. Some of these claims were patently preposterous. Others, resting, for example, on the Order's possible survival in Scotland, may well have a core of validity. By 1789, the legends surrounding the Templars had attained positively mythic proportions. They were regarded as occult adepts, illumined alchemists, magi and sages, master masons and high initiates, veritable supermen endowed with an awesome arsenal of arcane power and knowledge. They were also regarded as heroes and martyrs, harbingers of the anti-clerical spirit of the age, and many French Freemasons, in conspiring against Louis XVI, felt they were helping to implement Jacques de Molay's dying curse on the French line. Since the French Revolution, the aura surrounding the Templars has not diminished. At least 3 contemporary organizations today call themselves Templars, claiming to possess a pedigree from 1314 and charters whose authenticity has never been established. Certain Masonic lodges have adopted the grade of Templar, as well as rituals and appellations supposedly descended from the original order. Towards the end of the 19th century, a sinister Order of the New Templars was established in Germany and Austria, employing the swastika as one of its emblems. In the United States, teenage boys are admitted into the de Molay Society without either they or their mentors having much notion whence the name derives. In Britain, as well as elsewhere in the West, recondite rotary clubs dignify themselves with the name Templar and include eminent public figures. In France, the Templars are a veritable industry. In Paris, bookshops are filled with histories and accounts of the order, some valid, some plunging enthusiastically into lunacy. At the same time, there are, unquestionably, mysteries associated with the Templars, and we became convinced secrets of some kind as well. It was clear that some of these secrets pertain to what is now called esoterica. Symbolic carvings in Templar preceptories, for instance, suggest that some officials in the order's hierarchy were conversant with such disciplines as astrology, alchemy, sacred geometry and numerology, as well, of course, as astronomy, which in the 12th and 13th centuries was inseparable from astrology. Esoteric secrets the Templars may well have had, but something else about them was being concealed as well, something rooted in the religious and political currents of their epoch. It was on this level that we undertook most of our investigation. We began with the end of the story, the fall of the order and the charges levelled against it. Many books have been written exploring and evaluating the possible truth of these charges, and from the evidence we, like most researchers, concluded there seems to have been some basis for them. Subjected to interrogation by the Inquisition, for example, a number of knights referred to something called Baphomet, too many and in too many different places for Baphomet to be the invention of a single individual or even a single preceptory. In some instances, the name is associated with the gargoyle-like demonic sculptures found in various preceptories. On other occasions, Baphomet seems to be associated with an apparition of a bearded head. Despite the claims of certain older historians, it seems clear that Baphomet was not a corruption of the name Muhammad. On the other hand, it might have been a corruption of the Arabic Abu Fihamat, pronounced in Moorish Spanish as Baphomet. This means father of understanding or father of wisdom, and father in Arabic is also taken to imply source. If this is indeed the origin of Baphomet, it would therefore refer, presumably, to some supernatural or divine principle. But what might have differentiated Baphomet from any other supernatural or divine principle remains unclear. We found indisputable evidence for the charge of secret ceremonies involving a head of some kind. The existence of such a head proved to be one of the dominant themes running through the Inquisition records. As with Baphomet, however, the significance of the head remains obscure. Recent speculation had linked the head tentatively with the severed head of John the Baptist, and certain writers have suggested that the Templars were infected with the Johannite or Mandean heresy, which denounced Jesus as a false prophet and acknowledged John as the true Messiah. In the course of their activities in the Middle East, the Templars undoubtedly established contact with Johannite sects, and the possibility of Johannite tendencies in the order is not altogether unlikely. But one cannot say that such tendencies obtained for the order as a whole, nor that they were a matter of official policy. During the interrogations following the arrests in 1307, a head also figured in two other connections. According to the Inquisition records, among the confiscated goods of the Paris preceptory, a reliquary in the shape of a woman's head was found. It was hinged on top and contained what appeared to have been relics of a peculiar kind. It is described as follows. A great head of gilded silver, most beautiful and constituting the image of a woman. Inside were two head bones, wrapped in a cloth of white linen with another red cloth around it. A label was attached, on which was written the legend, Caput LVIIIM. The bones inside were those of a rather small woman. A curious relic, especially for a rigidly monastic military institution like the Templars. The head figures again in another mysterious story traditionally linked with the Templars. It's worth quoting in one of its several variants. A great lady of Maraclare was loved by a Templar, but she died in her youth, and on the night of her burial, this wicked lover crept to the grave, dug up her body, and violated it. Then a voice from the void bade him return in 9 months' time, for he would find a son. He obeyed the injunction, and at the appointed time he opened the grave again, and found a head on the leg bones of the skeleton, skull and crossbones. The same voice bade him guard it well, for it would be the giver of all good things. And so he carried it away with him. It became his protecting genius, and he was able to defeat his enemies by merely showing them the magic head. In due course, it passed into the possession of the order. This grisly narrative can be traced at least as far back as one Walter Mapp, writing in the late 12th century. But neither he nor another writer, who recounts the same tale nearly a century later, specifies that the necrophiliac rapist was a Templar. But by 1307, the story had become closely associated with the order. It is mentioned repeatedly in the Inquisition's records, and at least two knights, under interrogation, confessed their familiarity with it. In subsequent accounts, like the one quoted, the rapist himself is identified as a Templar, and he remains so in the versions preserved by Freemasonry, which adopted the skull and crossbones and often employed it as a device on tombstones. Whatever significance might be ascribed to the cult of the head, the Inquisition clearly believed it to be important. In a list of charges drawn up on August 12, 1308, there is the following. Item: that in each province they had idols, namely heads. Item: that they adored these idols. Item: that they said that the head could save them. Item: that it could make riches. Item: that it made the trees flower. Item: that it made the land germinate. Item: that they surrounded or touched each head of the aforesaid idols with small cords, which they wore around themselves next to the shirt or the flesh. The cord, mentioned in the last item, is reminiscent of the Cathars, who were also alleged to have worn a sacred cord of some kind. But most striking in the list is the head's purported capacity to engender riches, make trees flower, and bring fertility to the land. These properties coincide remarkably with those ascribed in the romances to the Holy Grail. Of all the charges levelled against the Templars, the most serious were those of blasphemy and heresy, of denying, trampling, and spitting on the cross. It is not clear precisely what this alleged ritual was intended to signify. Were they repudiating Christ, or were they simply repudiating the crucifixion? And whatever they repudiated, what exactly did they extol in its stead? One knight testified that on his induction into the order he was told, "You believe wrongly, because he, Christ, is indeed a false prophet. Believe only in God in heaven, and not in him." Such accounts are frequent and consistent enough to lend credence to the charge. There seems little doubt that the Templars' attitude towards Jesus did not concur with that of Catholic orthodoxy, but it is uncertain precisely what the order's attitude was. In any case, there is evidence that the ritual ascribed to the Templars, trampling and spitting on the cross, was in the air at least half a century before 1307. It is mentioned in connection with the Sixth Crusade, which occurred in 1249. If the end of the Knights Templar was fraught with baffling enigmas, the foundation and early history of the order seem to us to be even more so. Nine knights, nine poor knights, appeared as if from nowhere and promptly had the king's quarters turned over to them. Nine poor knights, without admitting any new recruits to their ranks, presumed all by themselves to defend the highways of Palestine. And there was no record at all of them actually doing anything, not even from Fulk de Chartres, the king's official chronicler, who must surely have known about them. What could we conclude from this? That the knights were not engaged in the laudable public service ascribed to them? That they were perhaps involved instead in some more clandestine activity of which not even the official chronicler was aware? Or that the chronicler himself was muzzled? The latter would seem to be the most likely explanation. For the knights were soon joined by two most illustrious noblemen, noblemen whose presence could not have gone unnoticed. According to Guillaume de Thier, the Order of the Temple was established in 1118, originally numbered nine knights, and admitted no new recruits for 9 years. It is clearly on record, however, that the Count of Anjou, father of Geoffrey Plantagenet, joined the order in 1120, only 2 years after its supposed foundation. And in 1124, the Count of Champagne, one of the wealthiest lords in Europe, did likewise. If Guillaume de Thier is correct, there should have been no new members until 1127. But by 1126, the Templars had in fact admitted four new members to their ranks. Is Guillaume wrong, then, in saying that no new members were admitted for 9 years? Or is he perhaps correct in that assertion, but wrong in the date he attributes to the order's foundation? If the Count of Anjou became a Templar in 1120, and if the order admitted no new members for 9 years after its foundation would date not from 1118, but at the latest from 1111 or 1112. Indeed, there is very persuasive evidence for this conclusion. In 1114, the Count of Champagne was preparing for a journey to the Holy Land. Shortly before his departure, he received a letter from the Bishop of Chartres. The bishop wrote, "We have heard that before leaving for Jerusalem, you made a vow to join La Milice du Christ, that you wished to enroll in this evangelical soldiery." La Milice du Christ was the name by which the Templars were originally known. In itself, an earlier foundation date for the Order of the Temple need not necessarily be suspicious, but there are other circumstances and singular coincidences which decidedly are. At least three of the nine founding knights seem to have been vassals of the same lord. This lord was the Count of Champagne, to whom the Bishop of Chartres addressed his letter in 1114, and who became a Templar in 1124, pledging obedience to his own vassal. In Troyes, the court of the Count of Champagne, an influential school of Kabbalistic and esoteric studies, had flourished since 1070. At the Council of Troyes in 1128, the Templars were officially incorporated. For the next two centuries, Troyes remained a strategic centre for the order, and it was from Troyes that one of the earliest Grail romances issued. Amid this welter of data, we could begin to see a tenuous web of connections, a pattern that seemed more than mere coincidence. One basis for our speculation was the specific site of the knight's domicile, the wing of the royal palace, the Temple Mount. In AD 70, the temple which then stood there was sacked by Roman legions under Titus. Its treasure was plundered and brought to Rome. But what if there was something else in the temple as well, something even more important than the treasure pillaged by the Romans? It might well be concealed somewhere nearby, beneath the temple, for instance. Among the Dead Sea Scrolls found at Qumran, there is one now known as the Copper Scroll. This scroll, deciphered at Manchester University in 1955-56, makes explicit references to great quantities of bullion, sacred vessels, additional unspecified material, and treasure of an indeterminate kind. It cites 24 different hoards buried beneath the temple itself. In the mid-12th century, a pilgrim to the Holy Land, one Johann von Würzburg, wrote of a visit to the so-called Stables of Solomon. These stables, situated directly beneath the temple itself, are still visible. They were large enough, Johann reported, to hold 2,000 horses, and it was in these stables that the Templars quartered their mounts. According to at least one other historian, the Templars were using these stables for their horses as early as 1124. It would thus seem likely that the fledgling order, almost immediately after its inception, undertook excavations beneath the temple. Such excavations might well imply that the knights were actively looking for something. It might even imply that they were deliberately sent to the Holy Land with the express commission of finding something. If this supposition is valid, it would explain a number of anomalies. Their installation in the royal palace, for example, and the silence of the chronicler. But if they were sent to Palestine, who sent them? In 1104, the Count of Champagne had met in conclave with certain high-ranking nobles, at least one of whom had just returned from Jerusalem. Among those present at this conclave were representatives of certain families who figured significantly in our story. Also present was the liege lord of André de Montbard, André being one of the co-founders of the temple, and Saint Bernard's uncle. Shortly after the conclave, the Count of Champagne departed for the Holy Land himself and remained there for 4 years, returning in 1108. In 1114, he made a second journey to Palestine, intending to join the Milice du Christ, then changing his mind and returning to Europe a year later. On his return, he immediately donated a tract of land to the Cistercian order. On this tract of land, Saint Bernard built the Abbey of Clairvaux, where he consolidated the Cistercian order. Prior to 1112, the Cistercians were dangerously close to bankruptcy. Then, under Saint Bernard's guidance, they underwent a dazzling change of fortune. Within the next few years, half a dozen abbeys were established. By 1153, there were more than 300, of which Saint Bernard himself personally founded 69. This extraordinary growth directly parallels that of the Order of the Temple, which was expanding in the same way during the same years. And as we've said, one of the co-founders of the Order of the Temple was Saint Bernard's uncle, André de Montbard. As we pondered this sequence of events, we became increasingly convinced that there was some pattern underlying and governing such an intricate web, the full details of which had been lost to history. In order to reconstruct these details, we developed a tentative hypothesis which might accommodate the known facts. We supposed that something was discovered in the Holy Land either by accident or design, something of immense import, which aroused the interest of some of Europe's most influential noblemen. We further supposed that this discovery involved, directly or indirectly, a great deal of potential wealth, as well, perhaps, as something else, something that had to be kept secret, something which could only be divulged to a small number of high-ranking lords. Finally, we supposed that this discovery was reported and discussed at the conclave of 1104. Immediately thereafter, the Count of Champagne departed for the Holy Land himself, perhaps to verify personally what he had heard, perhaps to implement some course of action, the foundation, for example, of what subsequently became the Order of the Temple. In 1114, if not before, the Templars were established with the Count of Champagne playing some crucial role, perhaps acting as guiding spirit and sponsor. By 1115, money was already flowing back to Europe and into the coffers of the Cistercians, who, under Saint Bernard, and from their new position of strength, endorsed and imparted credibility to the fledgling Order of the Temple. Under Bernard, the Cistercians attained a spiritual ascendancy in Europe. Under Hugues de Payon and André de Montbard, the Templars attained a military and administrative ascendancy in the Holy Land, which quickly spread back to Europe. Behind the growth of both orders loomed the shadowy presence of uncle and nephew, as well as the wealth, influence, and patronage of the Count of Champagne. These three individuals constitute a vital link. They are like markers breaking the surface of history, indicating the dim configurations of some elaborate, concealed design. If such a design actually existed, it cannot, of course, be ascribed to these three men alone. On the contrary, it must have entailed a great deal of cooperation from certain other people and a great deal of meticulous organization. Organization is perhaps the key word, for if our hypothesis was correct, it would presuppose a degree of organization amounting to an order in itself, a third and secret order behind the known and documented orders of the Cistercians and the Temple. Evidence for the existence of such a third order was not long in arriving. In 1956, a series of books, articles, pamphlets, and other documents relating to Béranger Saunier and the enigma of Rennes-le-Château began to appear in France. This material has steadily proliferated and is now voluminous. Not surprisingly, this has served to whet the appetites of numerous independent researchers like ourselves. The original material seems to have issued from a single specific source. Someone clearly had a vested interest in promoting Rennes-le-Château, in drawing public attention to the story, in generating publicity and further investigation, while keeping themselves scrupulously in the shadows. The material disseminated since 1956 has taken a number of forms. Some of it has appeared in popular, even best-selling books, more or less sensational, more or less cryptically teasing. Thus, for example, Gérard de Sède has produced a sequence of works on such apparently divergent topics as the Cathars, the Templars, the Merovingian dynasty, the Rose Croix, Saunier, and Rennes-le-Château. In these works, Monsieur de Sède is often arch, coy, deliberately mystifying, and coquettishly evasive. His tone implies constantly that he knows more than he's saying, perhaps a device for concealing that he doesn't know as much as he pretends. But his books contain enough verifiable details to forge a link between their respective themes. Whatever else one may think of Monsieur de Sède, he effectively establishes that the diverse subjects to which he addresses himself somehow overlap and are interconnected. On the other hand, We could not but suspect that Monsieur de Sade's work drew heavily on information provided by an informant, and indeed Monsieur de Sade more or less acknowledges as much himself. Quite by accident, we learned who this informant was. In 1971, when we embarked on our first BBC film on Rennes Le Château, we wrote to Monsieur de Sade's Paris publisher for certain visual material. The photographs we requested were accordingly posted to us. Each of them, on the back, was stamped Plantard. The appendix to one of Monsieur de Sade's books consisted of an interview with one Pierre Plantard, and we subsequently obtained evidence that Pierre Plantard had been involved with certain of Monsieur de Sade's works. Eventually, Pierre Plantard began to emerge as one of the dominant figures in our investigation. In addition to books, there have been a number of articles in newspapers and magazines. There have been interviews with various individuals claiming to be conversant with one or another facet of the mystery. But the most interesting and important information has not, for the most part, appeared in book form. Most of it has surfaced elsewhere, in documents and pamphlets not intended for general circulation. Many of these documents and pamphlets have been deposited in limited, privately printed editions at the Bibliothèque Nationale in Paris. They seem to have been produced very cheaply, some, in fact, a mere typewritten pages, photo-offset and reproduced on an office duplicator. Of all the privately published documents deposited in the Bibliothèque Nationale, the most important is a compilation of papers entitled collectively Dossiers Secrets, Secret Dossiers. This compilation is now on microfiche. Until recently, however, it comprised a thin, nondescript folder with stiff covers, which contained a loose assemblage of ostensibly unrelated items. News clippings, letters pasted to backing sheets, pamphlets, numerous genealogical trees, and the odd printed page apparently extracted from the body of some other work. Periodically, some of the individual pages would be removed. At different times, other pages would be freshly inserted. On certain pages, additions and corrections would sometimes be made in a minuscule longhand. Later, these pages would be replaced by new ones, printed and incorporating all previous emendations. The bulk of the dossiers, which consists of genealogical trees, is ascribed to one Henri Lobineau, whose name appears on the title page. Two additional items in the folder declare that Henri Lobineau is a pseudonym, and that the genealogies are actually the work of a man named Leo Schidloff, an Austrian historian and antiquarian who purportedly lived in Switzerland and died in 1966. In 1978, we managed to locate Leo Schidloff's daughter, who was living in England. Her father, she said, was indeed Austrian. He was not a genealogist, however, but an expert and dealer in miniatures, who had written two works on the subject. In 1948, he had settled in London, where he lived until his death in Vienna in 1966, the year and place specified in the dossier's secrets. Miss Schidloff vehemently maintained that her father had never had any interest in genealogies, the Merovingian dynasty or mysterious goings-on in the south of France. And yet, she continued, certain people obviously believed he had. During the 1960s, for example, he had received numerous letters and telephone calls from unidentified individuals in both Europe and the United States who wished to meet with him and discuss matters of which he had no knowledge whatever. On his death in 1966, there was another barrage of messages, most of them inquiring about his papers. In the meantime, a new pamphlet had appeared in Paris. According to this pamphlet, Henri Lobineau was not Leo Schidloff after all, but a French aristocrat of distinguished lineage, Comte Henri de Lenoncourt. The question of Lobineau's real identity was not the only enigma associated with the dossier's secrets. There was also an item which referred to Leo Schidloff's leather briefcase. This briefcase, supposedly, contained a number of secret papers relating to Rennes Le Château between 1600 and 1800. Shortly after Schidloff's death, the briefcase was said to have passed into the hands of a courier, a certain Fakhar ul Islam, who, in February 1967, was to rendezvous in East Germany with an agent delegated by Geneva and entrusted to him. Before the transaction could be effected, however, Fakhar ul Islam was reportedly expelled from East Germany and returned to Paris to await further orders. On February the 20th, 1967, his body was found on the railway tracks at Menlon, having been hurled from the Paris-Geneva Express. The briefcase had supposedly vanished. We set out to check this lurid story as far as we could. French newspapers of February the 21st did confirm that a decapitated body had indeed been found on the tracks at Menlon. It was identified as that of a young Pakistani named Fakhar-ul-Islam. For reasons that remained obscure, the dead man had been expelled from East Germany and was travelling from Paris to Geneva, engaged, it appeared, in some form of espionage. According to the newspaper reports, the authorities suspected foul play, and the affair was being investigated by the DST, Directorate of Territorial Surveillance, or Counter-Espionage. On the other hand, the newspapers made no mention of Leo Schidloff, a leather briefcase, or anything else that might connect the occurrence with the mystery of Rennes Le Château. As a result, we found ourselves confronted with a number of questions. It was possible that Fakhar-ul-Islam's death was linked with Rennes Le Château, that the item in the dossier's secrets drew upon inside information inaccessible to the newspapers. On the other hand, the item in the dossier's secrets might have been deliberate and spurious mystification. One need only find any unexplained or suspicious death and ascribe it, after the fact, to one's own hobby horse. But why should someone deliberately try to create an atmosphere of sinister intrigue around Rennes Le Château? And who might gain from it? Less than a month later, another privately printed work was deposited in the Bibliothèque Nationale. It was called Le Serpent Rouge, The Red Serpent, and dated, symbolically and significantly enough, January 17th. Its title page ascribed it to three authors, Pierre Fougère, Louison Maxon, and Gaston de Coquer. Le Serpent Rouge is a singular work. It contains one Merovingian genealogy and two maps of France in Merovingian times, along with a cursory commentary. It also contains a ground plan of Saint-Sulpice in Paris, which delineates the chapels of the church's various saints. But the bulk of the text consists of 13 short prose poems of impressive literary quality, many of them reminiscent of the work of Rimbaud. Each of these prose poems is no more than a paragraph long, and each corresponds to a sign of the zodiac, a zodiac of 13 signs, with the 13th, Ophiuchus, or the serpent holder, inserted between Scorpio and Sagittarius. Narrated in the first person, the 13 prose poems are a type of symbolic or allegorical pilgrimage, commencing with Aquarius and ending with Capricorn, which, as the text explicitly states, presides over January the 17th. In the otherwise cryptic text, there are familiar references to the Blanchefort family, to the decorations in the church at Rennes Le Château, to some of Cernier's inscriptions there, to Poussin and the painting of Les Bergers d'Acadie, to the motto on the tomb, Et in Arcadia Ego. At one point, there is mention of a red snake, sighted in the parchments, uncoiling across the centuries, an explicit allusion, it would seem, to a bloodline or a lineage. And for the astrological sign of Leo, there is an enigmatic paragraph worth quoting in its entirety. From she whom I desire to liberate, there wafts towards me the fragrance of the perfume which impregnates the sepulchre. Formerly some named her Isis, queen of all sources, benevolent. Come unto me, all ye who suffer and are afflicted, and I shall give ye rest. To others she is Magdalene, of the celebrated vase filled with healing balm. The initiated know her true name, Notre Dame des Crosses. The implications of this paragraph are extremely interesting. Isis, of course, is the Egyptian mother goddess, patroness of mysteries. Numerous writers on mythology, anthropology, psychology, theology have traced the cult of the mother goddess from pagan times to the Christian epoch. And according to these writers, she is said to have survived under Christianity in the guise of the Virgin Mary. But according to the text in Le Serpent Rouge, the mother goddess of Christianity would not appear to be the Virgin. On the contrary, she would appear to be the Magdalene. Moreover, the text would seem to imply that Notre Dame does not apply to the Virgin either. That resonant title would also seem to refer to the Magdalene. But why should the Magdalene be revered as Our Lady, and still more, as a mother goddess? Maternity is the last thing generally associated with the Magdalene. In popular Christian tradition, she is a prostitute who finds redemption by apprenticing herself to Jesus, and she figures most noticeably in the fourth gospel, where she is the first person to behold Jesus after the resurrection. In consequence, she is extolled as a saint, especially in France, where, according to medieval legends, she is said to have brought the Holy Grail. And indeed, the vase filled with healing balm might well be intended to suggest the Grail. But to enshrine the Magdalene in the place usually reserved for the Virgin would seem, at very least, to be heretical. Whatever their point, the alleged authors of Le Serpent Rouge met with a gruesome fate. On March 6, 1967, Louis Saint-Maxent and Gaston de Coca were found hanged. And the following day, March 7th, Pierre Fugere was found hanged as well. One might immediately assume, of course, that these deaths were in some way connected with the composition and public release of Le Serpent Rouge. However, we could not discount an alternative explanation. If one wished to engender an aura of sinister mystery, it would be easy enough to do. One need only comb the newspapers until one found a suspicious death, or in this instance, three suspicious deaths. One might then append the names of the deceased to a pamphlet of one's own concoction and deposit that pamphlet in the Bibliothèque Nationale. It would be virtually impossible to expose such a hoax. But why perpetrate such a hoax at all? This is typical of the mystification that has attended the material which, since 1956, has been appearing fragment by fragment in France. Other researchers have encountered similar enigmas. Ostensibly plausible names have proved to be pseudonyms. Addresses, including addresses of publishing houses and organizations, have proved not to exist. References have been cited to books which no one, to our knowledge, has ever seen. Documents have disappeared, been altered, or inexplicably miscatalogued in the Bibliothèque Nationale. At times, one is tempted to suspect a practical joke. If so, however, it is a practical joke on an enormous scale, involving an impressive array of resources, financial and otherwise. And whoever might be perpetrating such a joke would seem to be taking it very seriously indeed. In the meantime, new material has continued to appear, with the familiar themes recurring like leitmotifs. Saunier, Rennes le Château, Poussin, Les Bergers d'Acadie, the Knights Templar, Dagobert II, and the Merovingian dynasty. From this ever-proliferating welter of information, certain key points emerge which constitute a foundation for further research. They can be summarized as follows. Number one, there was a secret order behind the Knights Templar, which created the Templars as its military and administrative arm. This order, which has functioned under a variety of names, is most frequently known as the Prieuré de Sion, Priory of Sion. Number two, the Prieuré de Sion has been directed by a sequence of Grand Masters, whose names are among the most illustrious in Western history and culture. Number three, although the Knights Templar were destroyed and dissolved between 1307 and 1314, the Prieuré de Sion remained unscathed. It has continued to function through the centuries. Acting behind the scenes, it has orchestrated certain of the critical events in Western history. Number four, the Prieuré de Sion exists today and is still operative. It is influential and plays a role in high-level international affairs as well as in the domestic affairs of certain European countries. To some significant extent, it is responsible for the body of information disseminated since 1956. Number five, the avowed and declared objective of the Prieuré de Sion is the restoration of the Merovingian dynasty and bloodline to the throne not only of France, but to the thrones of other European nations as well. And number six, the restoration of the Merovingian dynasty is sanctioned and justifiable, both legally and morally. Although deposed in the 8th century, the Merovingian bloodline did not become extinct. On the contrary, it perpetuated itself in a direct line from Dagobert II and his son, Sigisbert IV. By dint of dynastic alliances and intermarriages, this line came to include Godefroy de Bouillon, who captured Jerusalem in 1099, and various other noble and royal families past and present. Blanchefort, Gisors, Sinclair, Sinclair in England, Montesquieu, Montpezat, Poer, Lusignan, Plantard, and Habsburg-Lorraine. At present, the Merovingian bloodline enjoys a legitimate claim to its rightful heritage. We were extremely sceptical, like most people, about conspiracy theories of history, and most of the assertions quoted struck us as irrelevant, improbable, and/or absurd. But the fact remained that certain people were promulgating them, and doing so quite seriously, and there was reason to believe, from positions of considerable power. We therefore embarked on a systematic examination of what we had begun to call, ironically, the Pierre documents, and of the assertions they contained. We endeavoured to subject these assertions to careful critical scrutiny and determine whether they could be in any way substantiated. We did so with a cynical, almost derisory scepticism, fully convinced the outlandish claims would wither under even cursory investigation. Although we could not know it at the time, we were to be greatly surprised. Part 2. The Secret Society. As early as 1962, the Prieuré de Sion had been mentioned cryptically and in passing in a work by Gérard de Sède. The first detailed references to it that we found, however, was a single page in the Dossier Secret. At the top of this page, there is a quotation from René Grousset, one of the foremost 20th-century authorities on the Crusades. The quotation refers to Baudouin I, younger brother of Godefroy de Bouillon, Duke of Lorraine and conqueror of the Holy Land. On Godefroy's death, Baudouin accepted the crown offered him, and thereby became the first official king of Jerusalem. According to René Grousset, there existed through Baudouin I a royal tradition, and because it was founded on the Rock of Sion, this tradition was equal to the reigning dynasties in Europe. But Baudouin and his descendants were elected kings, not kings by blood. Why then should Grousset speak of a royal tradition which existed through him?
Grousset does not explain.
On the page in the Dossier Secret, Grousset's quotation is followed by an allusion to the mysterious Prieuré de Sion, or Ordre de Sion, as it was apparently called at the time. According to the text, the Ordre de Sion was founded by Godefroy de Bouillon in 1090, 9 years before the conquest of Jerusalem. Although there are other Prieuré documents which give the founding date as 1099. According to the text, Baudouin, Godefroy's younger brother, owed his throne to the order, and according to the text, the order's official seat or headquarters was a specific abbey, the Abbey of Notre-Dame de Mont de Sion in Jerusalem, or perhaps just outside Jerusalem, on Mount Sion, the famous high hill just south of the city. On consulting all standard 20th century works on the Crusades, we found no mention whatever of any Ordre de Sion. We therefore undertook to establish whether or not such an order ever existed. To do that, we were obliged to rummage through sheaves of antiquated documents and charters. We didn't just seek explicit references to the order, we also sought some trace of its possible influence and activities, and we endeavoured to confirm whether or not there was an abbey called Notre-Dame de Mont de Sion. To the south of Jerusalem looms the high hill of Mount Sion. In 1099, when Jerusalem fell to Godefroy de Bouillon's crusaders, there stood on this hill the ruins of an old Byzantine basilica, dating supposedly from the 4th century and called the Mother of All Churches, a most suggestive title. According to numerous extant charters, chronicles, and contemporary accounts, an abbey was built on the site of these ruins at the express command of Godefroy de Bouillon. It must have been an imposing edifice, a self-contained community, and this structure was called the Abbey of Notre-Dame du Mont de Sion. Someone obviously had to occupy the premises. Could they have been an autonomous order taking their name from the site itself? Could the occupants of the abbey indeed have been the Ordre de Sion? It was not unreasonable to assume so. The knights and monks who occupied the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, also installed by Godefroy, were formed into the Order of the Holy Sepulchre. The same principle might well have obtained for the occupants of the abbey on Mount Sion, and it would seem to have done so. According to the leading 19th-century expert on the subject, the abbey was inhabited by a chapter of Augustinian canons. The community assumed the double name of Sainte-Marie du Mont-Sion et du Saint-Esprit, and another historian, writing in 1698, is more explicit still. There were in Jerusalem during the Crusades knights attached to the abbey of Notre-Dame de Sion who took the name of Chevalier de l'Ordre de Notre-Dame de Sion. If this were not sufficient confirmation, we also discovered documents of the period, original documents, bearing the seal and signature of one or another prior of Notre-Dame de Sion. We could assert that an Ordre de Sion did exist by the turn of the 12th century. Whether or not the order had actually been formed earlier, however, remained an open question. The Priorat documents imply that it was, and there is some evidence to suggest that this may indeed have been the case. It's known that in 1070, 29 years before the First Crusade, a specific band of monks from Calabria in southern Italy arrived in the vicinity of the Ardennes Forest, part of Godefroy de Bouillon's domains. According to Gerard de Sed, this band of monks was led by an individual called Ursus, a name which the Priorat documents consistently associate with the Merovingian bloodline. On their arrival in the Ardennes, the Calabrian monks obtained the patronage of Matilda de Toscane, Duchess of Lorraine, who was Godefroy de Bouillon's aunt and, in effect, foster mother. From Matilda, the monks received a tract of land at Orval. Here an abbey was established to house them. Yet they did not remain at Orval very long. By 1108, they had mysteriously disappeared, and no record of their whereabouts survives. Tradition says they returned to Calabria. Before their departure from Orval, however, the Calabrian monks may have left a crucial mark on Western history. According to Gerard de Sed, they included the man subsequently known as Peter the Hermit. If this is so, it would be extremely significant, for Peter the Hermit is often believed to have been Godefroy de Bouillon's personal tutor. Nor is that his only claim to fame. In 1095, along with Pope Urban II, Peter made himself known throughout Christendom by charismatically preaching the need for a crusade, a holy war which would reclaim Christ's sepulchre and the Holy Lands from the hands of the Muslim infidel. Today, Peter the Hermit is regarded as one of the chief instigators of the Crusades. When Islam was established in the 7th century, it was at first accommodating to the Christian communities in its midst, communities sometimes orthodox, sometimes heterodox, sometimes heretical. During the 8th and 9th centuries, however, these communities were subjected to increasing persecution, and substantial numbers of Christians fled, taking with them their sacred texts and establishing new monasteries in Sicily and Calabria. It is conceivable that an order of monks with long-suppressed information about Jesus could have found their way to Calabria from Egypt, from Syria or Lebanon, from Asia Minor, perhaps from the Holy Land itself. And it is equally conceivable that an Italian noblewoman, Matilda de Toscane, could have granted them land in her husband's fiefdom of the Ardennes. In the process, she and her family could well have become privy to whatever secrets her beneficiaries harbored. Her beneficiaries may indeed have become beneficiaries in exchange for their information. If the monks at Orval had been driven from the Holy Land, their preaching of a crusade to reclaim their lost domain would be explicable enough. On the basis of hints intimated in the Priorat documents, we begin to wonder whether there might have been some sort of shadowy continuity between the monks of Orval, Peter the Hermit, and the Ordre de Sion. It would certainly seem that the monks at Orval were not just a random band of itinerant religious devotees. On the contrary, their movements, their collective arrival in the Ardennes from Calabria, and their mysterious disappearance en masse attest to some kind of cohesion. And if Peter were a member of this band of monks, his preaching of a crusade might have been a manifestation not of rampant fanaticism, but of calculated policy. If he was Godefroy's personal tutor, moreover, he might well have played some role in convincing his pupil to embark for the Holy Land. And when the monks vanished from Orval, they might not have returned to Calabria after all. They might have established themselves in Jerusalem, perhaps in the Abbey of Notre-Dame de Sion. This was only speculative hypothesis. However, we soon found fragments of circumstantial evidence to support it. When Godefroy de Bouillon embarked for the Holy Land, he is known to have been accompanied by an entourage of anonymous figures who acted as advisers and administrators. But Godefroy's was not the only Christian army to embark for Palestine. There were no less than three others, each commanded by an illustrious and influential Western potentate. If the crusade proved successful and a Frankish kingdom were established, any one of these four potentates would have been eligible to occupy its throne. And yet Godefroy seems to have known beforehand that he would be selected. Alone among the European commanders, he renounced his fiefs, sold all his goods, and made it apparent that the Holy Land, for the duration of his life, would be his domain. In 1099, immediately after the capture of Jerusalem, a group of anonymous figures convened in secret conclave. The identity of this group has eluded all historical inquiry, although Guillaume de Thiers, writing three quarters of a century later, reports that the most important of them was a certain bishop from Calabria. In any case, the purpose of the meeting was clear: to elect a king of Jerusalem. And despite a persuasive claim by Raymond, Count of Toulouse, the mysterious and obviously influential electors promptly offered the throne to Godefroy de Bouillon. With uncharacteristic modesty, Godefroy declined the title, accepting instead that of Defender of the Holy Sepulchre. In other words, he was a king in everything but name. And when he died in 1100, his brother Baudouin did not hesitate to accept the name as well. Could the mysterious conclave which elected Godefroy ruler have been the elusive monks from Orval, including perhaps Peter the Hermit, who was in the Holy Land at the time and enjoyed considerable authority? And could this same conclave have occupied the abbey on Mount Sion? Could these three ostensibly distinct groups of individuals, the monks from Orval, the conclave who elected Godefroy, and the occupants of Notre Dame de Sion, have been one and the same? The possibility cannot be proved, but neither can it be dismissed out of hand. And if it is true, it would certainly attest to the Order de Sion's power, a power which included the right to confer thrones. We had begun to discern a web of intricate, elusive, and provocative connections. On the basis of these connections, we had formulated a tentative hypothesis. Whether our hypothesis was accurate or not, we could not know, but the vestiges of a design had now become even more apparent. We assembled the fragments of the pattern as follows. Number one, in the late 11th century, a mysterious group of monks from Calabria appears in the Ardennes, where they are welcomed, patronized, and given land at Orville by Godefroy de Bouillon's aunt and foster mother. Number two, a member of this group may have been Godefroy's personal tutor and may have co-instigated the First Crusade. Number three, some time before 1108, the monks at Orville decamp and disappear. Although there is no record of their destination, it may well have been Jerusalem. Certainly Peter the Hermit embarked for Jerusalem, and if he were one of the monks at Orville, it is probable that his brethren later joined him. Number four, in 1099, Jerusalem falls, and Godefroy is offered a throne by an anonymous conclave, a leader of whom, like the monks of Orval, is of Calabrian origin. Number five. An abbey is built at Godefroy's behest on Mount Sion, which houses an order of the same name as itself, an order which may comprise the individuals who offered him the throne. Number six. By 1114, the Knights Templar are already active, perhaps as the Order de Sion's armed entourage. But their constitution is not negotiated until 1117, and they themselves are not made public until the following year. Number seven. In 1115, Saint Bernard, member of the Cistercian order, then on the brink of economic collapse, emerges as the preeminent spokesman of Christendom, and the formerly destitute Cistercians rapidly become one of the most prominent, influential, and wealthy institutions in Europe. Number eight. In 1131, Saint Bernard receives the Abbey of Orval, vacated some years before by the monks from Calabria. Orval then becomes a Cistercian house. Number nine. At the same time, certain obscure figures seem to move constantly in and out of these events, stitching the tapestry together in a manner that is not altogether clear. The Count of Champagne, for example, donates the land for St. Bernard's Abbey at Clairvaux, establishes a court at Treuil, whence the Grail romances subsequently issue, and in 1114 contemplates joining the Knights Templar, whose first recorded Grand Master, Hugues de Péan, is already his vassal. Number 10. André de Montpas, St. Bernard's uncle and an alleged member of the Ordre de Sion, joins Hugues de Péan in founding the Knights Templar. Shortly thereafter, André's two brothers join St. Bernard at Clairvaux. Number 11. St. Bernard becomes an enthusiastic public relations exponent for the Templars, contributes to their official incorporation and the drawing up of their rule, which is essentially that of the Cistercians, Bernard's own order. And number 12. Between approximately 1115 and 1140, both Cistercians and Templars begin to prosper, acquiring vast sums of money and tracts of land. Again, we could not but wonder whether this multitude of intricate connections was indeed wholly coincidental. Were we looking at a number of essentially disconnected people, events, and phenomena, which just happened to overlap and cross each other's paths? Or were we dealing with something that was not random or coincidental at all? Could the Ordre de Sion have actually stood behind both St. Bernard and the Knights Templar, and could both have been acting in accordance with some carefully evolved policy? The Priore documents give no indication of the Ordre de Sion's activities between 1118, the public foundation of the Templars, and 1152. For the whole of that time, it would seem the Ordre de Sion remained based in the Holy Land, in the abbey outside Jerusalem. Then, on his return from the Second Crusade, Louis VII of France is said to have brought with him 95 members of the order. According to the text, 62 members of the order were installed at a large priory of Saint-Sampson at Orléans, which King Louis had donated to them. Seven were reportedly incorporated into the fighting ranks of the Knight Templar, and 26, two groups of 13 each, were said to have entered the small priory of the Mount of Sion, situated at Saint-Jean-le-Blanc on the outskirts of Orléans. In trying to authenticate these statements, we suddenly found ourselves on readily provable ground. The charters by which Louis VII installed the Ordre de Sion at Orléans are still extant. The originals can be seen in the municipal archives of Orléans. In the same archives, there is also a bull dated 1178 from Pope Alexander III, which officially confirms the Ordre de Sion's possessions. They include houses and large tracts of land in Picardy, in France, in Lombardy, Sicily, Spain, and Calabria, as well as a number of sites in the Holy Land, including St. Léonard at Acre. If the Priore documents can be believed, 1188 was a year of crucial importance for both Sion and the Knights Templar. A year before, in 1187, Jerusalem had been lost to the Saracens, chiefly through the impetuosity and ineptitude of Gerard de Riedfort, Grand Master of the Temple. The text in the Dossier Secret is considerably more severe. It speaks not of Gerard's impetuosity or ineptitude, but of his treason. What constituted this treason is not explained, but as a result of it, the initiates of Sion are said to have returned en masse to France, presumably to Orléans. The events of 1187, Gerard de Riedfort's treason and the loss of Jerusalem, seem to have precipitated a disastrous rift between the Order of Sion and the Order of the Temple. It's not clear precisely why this should have occurred, but according to the Dossier Secret, the following year witnessed a decisive turning point in the affairs of both orders. In 1188, a formal separation supposedly occurred between the two institutions. The Ordre de Sion, which had created the Knights Templar, now washed its hands of its celebrated protégés. The parent, in other words, officially disowned the child. This rupture is said to have been commemorated by a ritual or ceremony of some sort. In the Dossier Secret and other Priore documents, it is referred to as the cutting of the elm, and allegedly took place at Gisors. The Priore documents were confirmed to the extent that a curious dispute did occur during a meeting between Henry II of England and Philippe II of France at Gisors in 1188, which involved the cutting of an elm. There is no external confirmation that this event was related in any way to either the Knights Templar or to the Ordre de Sion. On the other hand, the existing historical accounts of the affair are too scant to be accepted as definitive. It is extremely probable that the Templars were present at the incident. Richard I was frequently accompanied by Knights of the Order, and Gisors, 30 years before, had been entrusted to the Temple. From 1188 onwards, the Priory documents maintain the Knights Templar were no longer under the authority of the Ordre de Sion. From 1188 onwards, the Templars were officially free to pursue their own objectives and ends, to follow their own course through the remaining century or so of their existence. And in the meantime, as of 1188, the Ordre de Sion is said to have undergone a major administrative restructuring of its own. Until 1188, the Ordre de Sion and the Order of the Temple are said to have shared the same Grand Master, Hugues de Péan and Bertrand de Blanchefort, for example, would thus have presided over both institutions simultaneously. Commencing in 1188,